Hello, junkies. Welcome to the Nocturnal Throwback Podcast, the podcast where we repodcast the original Nocturnal that was released in 2007 and was written a chapter a week and released a chapter a week. A Herculean effort, a masterful attempt to hike up the curtain and let you guys see what's going on. This is the same book that eventually became the hardcover thriller from Crown Publishing that was released many, many years later. After this episode of Nocturnal Throwback, just 10 left. Just 10. What comes after this book? What will we podcast next? Well, frankly, we're not sure. But as soon as we figure it out, we will let you know. It will either be something brand new, or it will be nothing at all for a while, which will be unusual. But I mean, hey, come on. We've been doing this every Sunday since March of 2005. That's a lot of Sundays, yo. A lot of Sunday content. Now, of course, I hope we can keep it going, but we're just not sure at this point. For now, though, it's time to get into the carnage. It's time to visit San Francisco again. Here we go with the original Talkie Talk from the 2007-2008 run of Nocturnal, and then episode 31 in all of its bloody glory. Enjoy. Welcome to the free podcast novel Nocturnal. This is episode number 31. Nocturnal is a podcast-only novel. You can't buy in stores, and you can't peek at the end. Written and performed by Scott Sigler. More information and more free stories available at scottsigler.com. This book contains adult language, mature situations, and lots of violence. Hello, my junkies. I am back. I am back in the closet of doom. I am back in San Francisco. And although I don't know how long I'm going to be here, I will be here long enough to finish up Nocturnal. I believe it's going to take two more episodes, culminate in episode 33, maybe 34, depends on if I want to screw with you or not. This episode, episode 31, has 21 minutes of story. Now, a lot of you have been questioning this ridiculously long absence from the podcast, and those who have are not regularly reading things at scottsigler.com and not getting the newsletter. So for all of you, I will provide full disclosure as to where I've been, what's going on, and I will do that at the end of the episodes. I will also have some choice words for a few of my detractors, who have been less than kind on the forums over at scottsigler.com. The reason I'm going to talk about this again is the last time I talked about it and gave my 2 cents worth, it offended a few fans who felt they were being unfair with junkies. So to address that and let everyone know where I'm coming from, I'll explain the whole thing at the end of the episode. But first, we're going to have a very long story so far by the author, Murr Lafferty. Murr is making a run on Amazon with her book, Playing for Keeps, on August 25th. Most of you have heard of Murr and her free podcast, Playing for Keeps. Those of you who have not, she's going to introduce herself in the story so far. Now, the quality of the story so far is not that great because Murr recorded it in the bathroom at a coffee shop. She's on the road, but she's one of those people who knows promotion and knows that she's got to get something done and take that window of opportunity. So she took her computer into the bathroom at a public coffee shop and recorded some stuff for me for the story so far so she could introduce herself to all of you. And now I can say I had Murr Lafferty in the bathroom. Yeah. So here's her story so far. Immediately after that, we're going to roll into episode 31 of Nocturnal. And at the end of the episode, if you want to hear me blab about what's going on in my life, stay tuned. If not, turn it off, go on about your day. Let's get into it.
Hi, this is Murr Lafferty. I'm currently recording in the bathroom of a coffee shop in the Outer Banks, North Carolina, because Scott wanted me to do a story so far, and I am on vacation and far away from my rig. So, this is the internal mic on my computer, and I hope you enjoy the story so far. But first, Scott wanted me to plug my upcoming novel, Playing for Keeps, which is coming out on August 25th on Amazon.com. Playing for Keeps was a podcast, and you can go ahead and listen to it for free before you make your decision on whether you want to buy it or not. You can go to playingforkeepsnovel.com, check out the book, and then see if you want to buy it. And I'm asking everybody to go on August 25th to buy the book on Amazon.com and help push me up the charts, just like our buddy Scott did many times before. So, let's get to Nocturnal. Previously on Nocturnal, Firstborn led an attack on the city morgue, trying to assassinate forensics analyst Robin Hudson, but she had left for the day. Firstborn killed a guard, then tortured Dr. Stone Mason, Robin's mentor. Before he died, Mason revealed that Robin had left for the day, heading back to her apartment. San Francisco Police Chief Amy Zoe is trying to get her twin daughters back. The leader of the Nocturnals, Rex Deprovdichuk, murdered Amy's husband right in front of her, then took the twins as leverage. If Amy doesn't find a way to get certain gangsters onto a ship that evening, the girls die. Amy went on a rampage, telling Dmitry Vasilov, head of the Russian mob, and Frank Lanza, head of the San Francisco La Cosa Nostra, that they were expected at 2 a.m. the next morning on Pier 45 for an impromptu cruise above the World War II Liberty ship, the Jeremiah O'Brien. Suspended San Francisco homicide detective Brian Clauser, along with Alder and Adam Jessup, arrived at the hospital to rescue Jebediah Erickson, also known as the Savior. Newly equipped with a bulletproof coat, custom pistols, ceramic blades, and a spring-loaded wrist knife, Brian slid into the hospital undetected, hoping for a quick snatch-and-grab. His hopes were ruined when two uniformed police at Erickson's door tried to arrest him for the murder of retired detective Francis Parkmeyer. Brian found two guns pointed at him, but the situation got even worse as Rex, Sly, Suck, and the dog-faced Pierre appeared to kill Savior. Pierre killed one cop and wounded another, Officer Jason Green. Brian took cover in Erickson's room and traded fire with the monsters, wounding Sly and Rex. He killed Sucka in a brutal hand-to-hand battle. Brian tried to grab Erickson, but the man was handcuffed to his bed. With nowhere to run, Brian threw Erickson's entire bed out of the third-story window, tossed Officer Green on his shoulder, and jumped out into the night.
Brian Clauser sailed out into the San Francisco fog. A wounded cop on his shoulder, killer monsters behind him, and somewhere below, an old man handcuffed to a hospital bed. If there ever was a leap of faith, this was it, because he didn't know if he'd survive the three-story drop. Who told him he would? A surly, antisocial anarchist weapons maker and an old man with a cane that shot bullets. I mean, if you couldn't rely on guys like that to tell you the truth, who could you rely on? Brian had never jumped out of a three-story building, and certainly not carrying 200 pounds of limp cop on his shoulder. He'd subconsciously positioned his body for a 10-foot jump, because he'd made those before. His feet reached down, found nothing but air, and he started to tip forward. Officer Jason Green's weight also pulled him to the left. Brian hit face first. He felt his skin scrape away as he skidded and tumbled. Green tore free, both from the impact and because a blast of pain shot through Brian's left shoulder. He finally stopped rolling and skidding. Holy crap, did that hurt. He just lay here for a second. Yeah, that would be just the thing. Rex Deprovdichuk clutched his bleeding shoulder as he walked to the edge of the broken window. The hospital bed holding Savior was a ghastly gray-white against the nighttime grass and trees below. The other man, the one who'd killed Sucka, he was face down, not moving. Two other men were down there as well. Rex didn't know if there were more of them.
Sly, get me out of here. I have to get to the ship.
Sly nodded. He had also been shot, and a lot worse. Once in the shoulder, twice in the chest. His suit was ruined, and he wasn't moving very fast. Sly would be of no help killing that motherfucker down there.
Pierre, get down there and kill everyone. Meet us on the dock when you're finished.
Yes, my king.
Get up, yo! We gotta move!
Brian felt hands pulling at his shoulders, and that hurt pretty bad because something in there was broken. Had to be. It took him a second to remember where he was. Then his mind replayed images of the dog face, the snake man, and the snatch face he'd killed less than 30 seconds ago, and Brian scrambled to his feet. He turned back to look up at the hospital, only to see the dog face leaping out, tuxedo tails trailing behind, a sawed-off AA-12 automatic shotgun held like a pistol in one huge hand. And where he would land, about 15 feet away, lay a bleeding, unconscious Jebediah Erickson, still handcuffed to the twisted and broken bed. The dog face landed, quite a bit more gracefully than Brian had.
Yo, get him before he can get to Savior!
Gunfire opened up on Brian's left and on his right. On his left, the cane gun, fired by the wobbly old Alder Jessup. On his right, Adam hosing bullets with an Uzi. Their target covered his face with his arms and turned away. Bullets tore at the back of his tuxedo coat, tearing away the fabric and spraying blood onto the grass.
Brian, get him! We'll get Savior!
Adrenaline racing, Brian sprinted forward, reaching for his 5.7s before his cop mind math kicked in. He only had one bullet in the right gun and none in the left. He didn't have time to reload. He actually had to hit that giant thing. The bloody dog face seemed to sense the brief lull of bullets. He stood, turned, and roared all in the same motion. It would have been a very dramatic move, and the dog face would have undoubtedly puffed out its chest, tilted its head back, and roared a challenge, but it didn't get the chance. Brian put his shoulder into the thing's stomach like an all-pro linebacker blindsiding a third-string quarterback. The monster folded in half, let out a giant woof as the air ripped out of his lungs. It was a world-class hit, and Brian would have admired his handiwork, if he'd hit with his good shoulder. Pain erupted in his arm, his chest, and his shoulder. Something ground away in there. Something stabbed. His coat would stop bullets, but it wasn't a rigid suit of armor, and he took the impact directly on a spot that was clearly broken. The two fell to the ground, a tangled, uncoordinated mess of limbs and damaged bodies. Brian rolled off, more by accident than by intention. He pushed past the pain and stood up in what seemed to be slow motion. His left arm dangled uselessly. He reached for his right 5.7 and turned. The dogface still lay on the ground, one hand clutching its stomach, the other reaching for the AA-12 on the ground beside it. Maybe it was the surreal situation of fighting monsters, or the pain in his left shoulder, or that hot agony in the left side of his face. Whatever it was, Brian Clouser rushed his shot. He raised the 5.7 and fired. The bullet hit just to the left of the monster. His last bullet. And he'd missed. He had to reload, but he couldn't move his left arm. He had another ceramic knife, but in his right sleeve. Couldn't get to that with his wrecked left arm either. The spring-loaded knife on his left wrist. That was all he had. Brian reached back to holster the right-hand 5.7, then grabbed for his left forearm. The knife was meant to be fired one-handed, left-handed, a flick and a twist of the wrist. Could he even shoot it by reaching over with his right hand? The roar of shotgun blast shocked him, as did the impact of slugs hitting his right shoulder and his chest. Blasts, mind you, plural, as the motherfucker opened up on full auto. Brian dove to the left, that cop part of his brain counting 8 shots, each an infinitely long wait to know if it hit him in the head, despite the fact that all 8 shots went off in just 2 seconds. He hit the ground, landing, again, goddammit, on his left shoulder. More explosive pain, but he rolled and came up on his knees. He reached across himself, grabbing his left wrist, pulling it up to aim despite even more lava-rich pain. But there was no one there. The dog face was gone.
Let's go, yo!
Brian turned. Adam had Erickson over his shoulder. Alder was reloading his cane, taking a bullet from his pocket, sliding it into a hidden slot, then twisting the top of the cane with a click. Adam didn't say another word. He turned and ran for the car. Alder slid a little cap onto the end of his cane, then used it to walk as fast as he could. Brian took one more look for the giant dog-faced creature, but he was nowhere to be seen. That suited Brian just fine. Thanks to the 2 shotgun slugs, his right shoulder now hurt almost as bad as his left, and the dull pain on his right pectoral would have convinced him he was having a heart attack had it been 6 inches further left. Brian ignored the pain, or tried to, as he picked up Officer Green and threw him over his right shoulder. They all ran back to the black Dodge Magnum and put Erickson and Green gently inside the back. Brian then eased himself into the back seat, hissing with pain. He hadn't even shut the door when Adam peeled out, shooting back onto the street and far away from the hospital. Alarms blared through the hospital. Aggie James knew why. He just knew. Hillary had found out he had failed, and she had sent the monsters to drag him back, to make him do the groom's walk. He had to get out. He pulled at the handcuff that connected his wrist to the hospital bed. That wasn't coming off unless he tore his hand apart. While it might be worth it, it was beyond his level of discipline. The door to his room opened,
and an orderly rushed in, carrying a jangling set of keys.
We're evacuating. Can you walk?
Yeah. What's happening?
Some kind of shootout in the other wing, the orderly said, as he unlocked Aggie's handcuff. All the cops in the building are headed over there. We have to get everyone out. Now, if you can walk, follow the exit signs and get out of the building. There's other people I have to get who need more help than you.
The orderly ran out of the room. Aggie James had learned long ago not to look a gift horse in the mouth. He didn't spend a second wondering at his luck or trying to see if this was some kind of a trick. He ran out of the room and into a hallway of frightened confusion. Hospital staff helped weak old people or pushed wheelchairs or even rolled the gurneys, one hand on the frame, the other on IV poles that rolled along in time. Everywhere, patients in gowns moved towards exit signs, feet moving as fast as they could, naked asses peeking out. He looked at those exit signs, a neon red path to freedom. Then he looked away, towards a directory placard mounted on the wall. Little arrows told him which way to go. He turned away from the exit signs and headed for the maternity ward.
Just look at them, holding hands, kissing. He could see their tongues flicking in and out of each other's mouths. So unclean.
The rage built in his chest. So did the excitement. Everything seemed sharper, more intense, from the breeze blowing off the ocean to the sand grinding on his feet and belly to the smell of a dead fish that couldn't be far off. They couldn't see him. People couldn't really see at night, not like he could. And these people had a fire, blazing orange and hot against the pitch-black night. Their eyes would be adjusted to that light. They wouldn't be able to pick up anything 20 feet outside of their little bonfire. Tard could cover 20 feet in just a couple of seconds. Even if they did see him, they wouldn't have time to react. Probably wouldn't even have time to scream. A few other bonfires lit up the evening fog of Ocean Beach. Probably bums. This was a regular hunting ground for Sly and the others. Ocean Beach had no lights, a wide swath of sand that ran from the edge of Outer Sunset to the edge of the ocean. At night, fog made everything hard to see. Standing at the water's edge, you'd be practically invisible to anyone in the parking areas. This place was dangerous for regular people because of the bums and the homeless. So regular people didn't come here at night. Not very often. And these people looked normal. Bundled up in their blankets, laying there, holding hands, kissing. The boy crawled on top of the girl and started to move. It made Tard feel funny to watch, and that funny feeling made him even angrier. Tard slowly lifted off his belly and onto his feet, a sand-colored shape that rushed forward. The two people didn't even look up. Nick Murray loved America. Really, really loved it. As a child, he'd heard his grandfather say the streets of America were paved with gold. Nick had been here for 10 years now, and while the streets weren't paved with gold, the water was. Well, that wasn't quite right, but he'd never been that good with analogies. At any rate, a man who could swim and not ask questions could make money. A lot of money. As in, one night's work would earn him more money than he'd made in a year back in the service. He didn't have to shoot anyone, get shot at, or risk being killed either. Not if he didn't count a very small chance of being sucked into the Jeremiah O'Brien screw and being chopped to little underwater bits, of course. All he had to do was keep hiding under the O'Brien's hull, maybe for an hour or so, and wait for the signal. He had enough oxygen in the scuba tank for that, and his magnetic graspers would allow him to stay fast to the hull. If he got that signal, he had to work his way out from under the hull, making sure he stayed connected and didn't get washed behind, then locate his contact. That was the hardest part. Holding onto the ship, peeking his head out of the water, and spotting a man some 40 feet above on the deck. After that, wait for a rope to drop, hook it onto the airtight bag of guns he'd brought with. Once the guns went up and over the rail, Nick's work was finished. From there, he'd just let go and swim back to shore. He didn't know who the guns were for, and he didn't want to know. Wasn't his business. What his business was collecting the second half of the money from old man Zobikov. That would involve story time. It always did. Zobikov loved to hear tales of Nick's military past, when he went by his real name of Nikolai Moravnoy and was a member of Spetsnaz Vimpel, the Soviet Union's equivalent of the American Naval SEALs. Surely Bruce was about to get paid. Half up front, half after the flight. That was the deal. She'd charged triple her normal rate. That was gouging, sure, but you didn't get this far in the flight biz without picking up on vibes. It was one thing to move a little coke here, provide a quick getaway for some thug there. It was another when three guys showed up with suspiciously large duffel bags. One little guy, two big guys, all wearing nice suits. Guys like that, bags like that. That meant trouble. Trouble meant potential risk of damage, and potential risk of damage meant potential repairs. It was hard enough keeping a Huey running as it was.
That's a lot more money than we thought it was going to be,
the little one said.
That's the deal, Mr. Goldblum, Shirley said. I don't negotiate. I have no wish to piss off the Land's organization, trust me, but I wasn't born yesterday. You and your two friends here, you're loaded for bear.
But we're just shipping some product, same as always, the man said.
Your bags are a little lumpy for that, Pete, Shirley said. And I can smell the gun oil from here.
He stared at her. She smiled. She hoped it was a respectful smile. Even on best terms, a guy like Pete the fucking Jew Goldblum was not a man to piss off. Pete turned and looked at his two hulking friends. They had special forces written all over them. Pete looked annoyed that Shirley had seen through his story. He turned back.
All right, he said. $45,000. But for that kind of money, you're going all the way. You do whatever they tell you to do.
Like what?
Now Pete smiled.
It doesn't matter what. We just made a deal. If they tell you to fly it into the Transamerica building, then you do that.
Mr. Goldblum, I mean, the chopper can take a few rounds, but I can't put it in any real danger.
But Dalla, you already did. You put yourself in danger when you gouged me. For that price, if I hear back from them that you didn't do what they said, and we'll be looking for another pilot, another one, because there won't be a whole lot left of the first one. Do you understand me, Dalla?
Shirley nodded, despite the sinking feeling in her chest. This wasn't going to be an in and out. She should have charged quadruple. Black Mr. Burns knew one thing for damn sure. His hands on a computer felt far better than his hands on a gun. He didn't like guns. He'd do what had to be done to back any play of the ninja, but overall, Control-Alt-Delete was a much more preferable way to kill something. Finally, he had a chance to catch up. Pookie wanted him to research a Marie Luttrell. Nothing by that name in the police databases. Nothing in the local civic databases either. National crime databases? The same. Sounded like a common enough name, but she seemed to be a non-person. Finally, he gave up on the official sources and went with his last resort, Google. He tried Marie Luttrell in quotes, MarieLattrielle. Again, nothing. This was a serious non-name if there wasn't even a hit on Google. That meant not only could he not find out about Pookie's Marie Luttrell, but there wasn't any Marie Luttrell in the entire world with her name on a web page. That was damn near impossible, making it a very rare name indeed. He tried without quotes, and finally got a hit. She hadn't shown up because the page didn't show her name together, but he found it, a Marie Luttrell. The article wasn't even about her, it was about her husband. He read, that couldn't be the woman Pookie wanted to know about. It just couldn't. He picked up the phone to call Pookie, then paused as an alert flashed on his screen. He moved the mouse and clicked. The window opened, and Black Mr. Burns read about a very disturbing find at the morgue. Big Gay Max opened the door, and Emma shot out into the hall. She started whining and whimpering, running circles around Robin, jumping and clawing and bursting at the seams with desperate love.
"Hi, baby," Robin said.
She knelt down. She was going to get her face licked repeatedly, and she was going to take it like a good soldier, so to speak. Poor little thing.
"She's been sitting by the door for 4 hours,"
Max said.
"I tried to give her hamburger, and she wouldn't eat it." "Hamburger, Robin. That dog missed you like nobody's business."
Robin heard most of Max's words, but not all, because there was a big wet tongue lacking her ears as well as her face.
"Easy, baby, easy," Robin said.
She stood and used Emma's leash to make her stay down. Max was holding Bill above the pit bull in his usual position, cradled in one arm, like an old lady might hold a Pomeranian.
"It's okay, though. Billabub had Emma's back. Ate the hamburger, no problem."
Robin stood on her tiptoes to give Max a peck on the cheek.
"You, sir, are a prince. I'm headed for bed."
"You seem a bit more chipper than you have lately. Mr. Tall, Dark, and Hot Ass, and you have a talk?"
Robin laughed. Was it that obvious?
"As a matter of fact, we did."
"Did you set him straight, honey?"
She shrugged.
"We'll see. I let him know how I feel, though. So now the ball's in his court. It's off my shoulders, and I gotta tell you, that feels amazing."
"Good for you, girl."
"Night, Max,"
she said, and walked towards her apartment. 5 feet from the door, she felt a yank on the leash. That often happened during walks when Emma was lagging behind, and suddenly decided that something had to be sniffed that very second. Robin turned to see what on earth Emma could sniff in an apartment hallway. But Emma wasn't sniffing. Her feet were planted out in front of her. Her head was down, and her lip was curled up like Cujo. A low growl burbled from her throat. A ridge of fur stood up on her back like a fin. The sound sent a chill through Robin's stomach. She'd never heard Emma growl like that. Never. Emma was staring at the apartment door. Robin turned to look at it. There was a light on inside. She always left the lights on. Fuck Al Gore. She wasn't coming home to a dark apartment for anyone. She could see the light at the base of the door. And then, a quick shadow. There and gone. Someone was inside her apartment.
And there we go with Nocturnal episode 31. I think you guys can see how things are shaping up. Looking to have a big finale, big old fat finale. Might be episode 33, might sneak into episode 34. I'm not entirely sure. So where have I been all this time? Where has the Nocturnal story been all this time? For those of you who are still listening and wrote it out, I really appreciate it. This episode is an actual month after the last episode. That's pretty bad. So let me explain what's been going on. First of all, the sequel to Infected, Contagious, is going to be in stores December 30th. Crown decided to push that up. It was supposed to be out in May. They wanted to push that up so they could get it in stores December 30th, right at the beginning of the year, because they wanted to capitalize on the momentum of Infected. Well, if you can imagine taking your daily job and taking something that should, a project that should take you a year, and then someone trims 5 months off of that and says, get it done, all of it, in 7 months, you're going to have to sacrifice a few things. And that's what I did to be a good partner to my publishing company. We got Contagious done. I just submitted the third draft. It's in pretty good shape. We're going to get one more high-level pass at it, and then it's going to be off to the printer. Now, the whole reason that everybody in the Patio Books game gives you this free content is because we're trying to improve our career as writers. Here I am with Infected that came out in hardcover and did pretty well. Well enough the publisher wants to follow up with the sequel immediately. A humongous opportunity for an author to have that kind of vote of confidence from the publisher. So I took it. I took that opportunity, and it took up a lot of time. I thought I was going to have Contagious done a month ago, based on how I had plotted things out. But a couple of things came up in my life. Of course, the first thing is my dearly beloved little dog Mookie passed on, and that was a difficult time for me. I lost 3, maybe 4, maybe 5 days from that, and there was some time I really wasn't all that effective being an author. And whether you think that's a valid excuse or not, it was valid for me. And the grieving process took me a little bit of time to deal with it. The next thing that happened was a lot worse. My father-in-law went into the hospital for surgery. There were complications. He has been in the hospital ever since, in the intensive care ward.
I have spent a lot of time back in Michigan trying to be there for my wife and her family. I had to cancel my 20th high school reunion, which happened, I was supposed to go back to Michigan for that. Couldn't make it up because it was more important to stay with the family. Had to cancel a couple of book readings. Was out of my environment. Couldn't do any recording during that whole time, obviously, because I was nowhere near a microphone. And that clearly chewed up a lot of time. So cramming to get Contagious done to the quality you all deserve, dog dying, father-in-law in the hospital, bit of a rough patch for me. During this time, I started to take a little bit of flack from some of the junkies. Most of the junkies were very understanding of the situation, had a lot of nice things to say. A very small minority had some really nasty, nasty things to say. I responded to those things and basically gave everyone a piece of my mind about that. The piece of my mind wound up offending other junkies who didn't know the context of the situation. They just heard me bitching at people. One of the emails was, hey, people make fun of you all the time. What, are you too big now for people to make fun of you? Definitely not. As most of you know and make fun of me all the time, it's not that. It's part of the give and take that we all have in junkie land. But some of the stuff showed such an utter disrespect for the situation, an utter sense of entitlement that no matter what happens in your life, Scott, we get our stuff. And if you don't give us our stuff, then you're a douchebag. While I am clearly a douchebag of the highest caliber, some of this stuff got to the point where it really pissed me off. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to share with you the letter that was posted on the forums that prompted that response. If you've already heard the stuff or you don't care about the drama, just turn it off. Now, to put this further into context, I think people need to understand that, you know, it takes me 5 to 8 hours to do a podcast episode. Nocturnal's not finished. I've been trying to write Nocturnal and finish Contagious, which sort of came out of nowhere. And all these things, all these random excuses popped up. But I take the junkies extremely seriously. I value your time in listening to these stories. I bust my ass to get stuff done for you to keep that momentum going and keep giving you guys back because you guys give me so much and I wouldn't have a career without you. So some of the things that this guy said were just too far out there. So let me begin. I quote, "You are really going to wait almost a month between new chapter releases of Nocturnal so you can spam us with more infected posts. What the fuck? This is sloppy and disrespectful to listeners. Not to mention abuse of an RSS feed if there ever was one. Some dark overlord can't even get a book done or chapters out in a timely fashion. Does it really seem like a good idea to stop the book you are syndicating in order to send out numerous episodes of a book that most of us have already read? I, for one, will never ever buy a Scott Sigler book. I'll get it all for free and never pay one dime. Sorry, but that's what it's worth at this point. Not that your stories are bad, Scott, but I'm afraid I'll flip a page and instead of the next chapter, it will actually have chapters from another previously released but repackaged book, never knowing when the original story will resume. Advice from a listener, get your shit together. The way you have handled last month of this feed has been a slap in the face to your junkies. My advice, just finish the book and release the rest as one episode. Say you're sorry and give away a lot of Podshow Sigler swag or something. Post humbly. Don't post with the fake gusto and inflated ego we usually see. You can't live up to it anymore. Sorry, man. Figure it out already. You are actually getting worse in your consistency in relation to your other books. You've probably seen your numbers fall quite a bit during this. Don't be surprised. Just figure it out, stay focused, have respect for your fucking audience. Going a month without a relevant release is a douchebag move. $20 says your next patio book is a sequel to something you've already started. Not the worst idea, but definitely because we know not to get invested with new characters or a plotline or, sincerely, Ben. Have respect for your listeners. We make you, we can break you. It's not your content, it's our enthusiasm. When that goes away, so do you, my friend. Ciao. P.S. Thanks, moderators, for removing this. I hope you read it first. Not being mean, just a frustrated subscriber. What can I say?" Well, first of all, we did not remove that. We left it up. We almost never remove anything that's on any of the forums. People have something to say, they can come right in and they can say it. Not a lot of authors are going to do that. Some will. I'm one of the minority. So Ben, it got to stay up. That's what I responded to so harshly a couple of episodes ago. Now, it was a little weird to get some of this because I had communicated to you all that I was re-releasing Infected because I had re-recorded the whole thing and it had a bunch of new content. In fact, I'd say it's about 20% new story that wasn't there before. I communicated this to everyone. I said, if you don't like it, just delete it. It's a friggin' data file. If you don't like it coming through your pipe, delete it when it gets there. Believe me, it is far more complicated to have multiple feeds for people to subscribe to than it is to have everything going through one feed. Trust me, I know this better than anyone else when I changed the feed from Earthcore to Ancestor and from Ancestor to Infected. A lot of you people understand RSS very well. The vast majority of you do not. I do not. When I subscribe to one feed, I want everything coming through that feed. I subscribe to J.C. Hutchins' single feed. There's a lot of stuff in there that I don't want. Doesn't matter because I get the stuff that I do want and I don't have to think about where to go find it. Second, the disrespect to the listeners. What kind of a stupid fuckhead would say that? You guys go out and find me one other author on a major imprint that gives away all of his stories for free. Go find me one other author that when he got a publishing deal, told the publisher, I will not sign with you unless I have the right to give away everything that you're selling as a free podcast. You can look all you want. Other than Cory Doctorow, who's published by Tor, I don't think you're going to find any, at least none that I know of. I put my whole potential career, the whole deal in jeopardy, because I said, I don't care if you're going to sell the audiobook. We have to find a solution because I will continue to dance with the one that brought me. I will give away all of my content as long as I live, free, as episodic, downloadable podcasts. And if you don't like it, just don't sign me because we're not going to be happy together. Now imagine somebody hires you to be a car salesman and you go in and tell them, I'm going to give away all the car repairs that I can in hopes that they will actually come in and buy a full car from me. The service department manager is probably going to hit you in the head with a pipe wrench. The myopic view of this person to say that I don't respect my listeners is sheerly astounding. The lack of intelligence to process the fact that everything is given away for free, even though it's also for sale and usually given away free in a couple of different forms, just in case you don't like the podcast, you can go get the PDF, etc. Thirdly, that the reason everything got delayed was because of some pretty severe family troubles. Personal life got in the way. A career, that's contagious. You got to take care of the book first if you want to have time to be a writer in order to give you guys your stories. B, family. That's got to come before everything else. I thought I had communicated all of that to all the junkies, and then to get this kind of feedback, absolutely astounding. Now, this guy is in the minority. This guy clearly doesn't have any perspective on reality. He doesn't have any concept of the more important things that are going on in life instead of getting his free story every week. He's free to unsubscribe. He's free to stay subscribed. He can do whatever the hell he wants. You junkies can always do whatever the hell you want. And more importantly, he's also free to express his opinion on the forums. You can email me, you can IM me, post it on the forums. We're not going to pull it down. Go crazy. So while I embrace his right to post the information, while I embrace the right of him to have his opinion, I still have the right to take offense to something and to communicate it. So that's what I was lashing out against. As you can see, this wasn't just some junkie coming in and making fun of me or ripping on me for not having the episodes out on time. That is the last I will speak of this issue. People are free to come in and say whatever the hell they want to say. I am also free to say at any time, if you don't like it and you're not enjoying the culture that we have in junkie land and siglerism, bail out, man. Just bail out. My attitude is not going to be right for everyone. We've always known this. I think it's always been fairly obvious that from time to time, I'll say what's on my mind. But I wanted to share that with all of you so that you at least understood where I was coming from. I will try to not talk about this stuff on the feed anymore. It's obviously annoying to a lot of you, so we're going to let it go. But I want to take this last opportunity to communicate what was going on, put everything in perspective. And now I'm spent. So now that Contagious is done until this Friday when I get the pages back, there will be more stuff coming in the feed. I'm going to make it right by you guys. I'm going to make all of this right. Talk to you the next
episode. You have been listening to Nocturnal, written and performed by Scott Sigler. For more information, go to scottsigler.com. All music in this podcast provided by Uncrowned off their album Devils and Angels, available now at the iTunes Music Store. Is it?